The physical body, as we know, has remained substantially the same size for long ages. The astral body grows to some extent, but the mental body, as well as the causal body, expands enormously in the later stages of evolution, manifesting the most gorgeous radiance of many colored lights glowing with intense splendor when at rest, and sending forth dazzling coruscations when in high activity. In a very undeveloped person, the mental body is even difficult to distinguish. It is so little evolved that some care is needed to see it at all. Large numbers of people are as yet incapable of clear thought, especially in the West with regard to religious matters. Everything is vague and nebulous. For occult development, vagueness and nebulosity will not do. Our conceptions must be clear-cut and our thought images definite. These, apart from other characteristics, are essentials in the life of the occultist. The student should realize also that each man necessarily views the external world through the medium of his own mind. The result may be aptly compared to looking at a landscape through colored glass. A man who has never seen except through red or blue glasses would be unconscious of the changes which these made on the true colors of the landscape. Similarly, a man is usually entirely unconscious of the distorting effect due to his seeing everything through the medium of his own mind. It is in this somewhat obvious sense that the mind has been called the creator of illusion. The student of occultism clearly has the duty of so purifying and developing his mental body, eliminating warts, CP.31, and prejudices, so that his mental body reflects the truth with a minimum of distortion due to the defects of the mental body. The effect of a man on animals is a matter which we should deal briefly in order to make complete our study of the mental body, its actions and reactions. If a man turns affectionate thought upon an animal, or makes a distinct effort to teach him something, there is a direct and intentional action passing from the astral or mental body of the man to the corresponding vehicle of the animal. This is comparatively rare, the greater portion of the work done being without any direct volition on either side, simply by the incessant and inevitable action due to the proximity of the two entities concerned. The character and type of the man will have a great influence on the destiny of the animal. If the interaction between them is mainly emotional, the probability is that the animal will develop mainly through his astral body, and that the final breaking of the link with the group soul will be due to a sudden rush of affection which will reach the Buddhic aspect of the monad floating above it, and thus cause the formation of the ego. If the interaction is mainly mental, the nascent mental body of the animal will be stimulated, and the animal will probably individualize through the mind. If a man is intensely spiritual or of strong will, the animal will probably individualize through the stimulation of his will. Individualization through affection, intellect, and will are the three normal methods. It is also possible to individualize by less desirable means, e.g., through pride, fear, hate, or lust for power. Thus, for example, a group of about 2 million egos individualized in the seventh round of the moon chain entirely through pride, possessing but little of any quality other than a certain cleverness, their causal bodies consequently showing almost no color but orange. The arrogance and unruliness of this group caused all through history constant trouble to themselves and to others. Some of them became the lords of the dark face in Atlantis. Others became world-devastating conquerors or unscrupulous millionaires, well called Napoleons of finance. Some of those who individualized through fear, engendered by cruelty, became the inquisitors of the page 110 Middle Ages, and those who torture children at the present day. Further details on the mechanisms of individualization will be found in A Study of Consciousness, by Dr. Besant, pages 172-3. It would also be dealt with in the causal body. Chapter 14 Faculties. The mental body, like the astral body, can in process of time be aroused into activity, and will learn to respond to the vibrations of the matter of its own plane, thus opening up before the ego an entirely new and far wider world of knowledge and power. The full development of consciousness in the mental body must not, however, be confounded with merely learning to use the mental body to some extent. A man uses his mental body whenever he thinks, but that is very far from being able to utilize it as an independent vehicle through which consciousness can be fully expressed. As we saw before, p. 20, the mental body of the average man is much less evolved than is his astral body. In the majority of men, the higher portions of the mental body are as yet quite dormant, even when the lower portions are in vigorous activity. The mental body of an average man, in fact, is not yet in any true sense a vehicle at all, for the man cannot travel about in it, nor can he employ its senses for the reception of impressions in the ordinary way. Among the scientific men of our time, although the mental body will be very highly developed, yet this will be chiefly for use in the waking consciousness and very imperfectly as yet for direct reception on the higher planes. Very few, apart from those who have been definitely trained by teachers belonging to the great brotherhood of initiates, consciously work in the mental body. To be able to do so means years of practice in meditation and special effort. Up to the time of the first initiation, a man works at night in his astral body, but as soon as it is perfectly under control and he is able to use it fully, work in the mental world is begun. When the mental body is completely organized, it is a far more flexible vehicle than the astral body, and much that is impossible on the astral plane can be accomplished therein. The power to function freely in the mental world must be acquired by the candidate for the second initiation, because that initiation takes place on the lower mental plane. Just as the vision of the astral plane is different from that of physical plane, so is the vision of the mental plane totally different from either. In the case of mental vision, we can no longer speak of separate senses such as sight and hearing, but rather have to postulate one general sense which responds so fully to the vibrations reaching it that when any object comes within its cognition, it at once comprehends it fully, and, as it were, sees it, hears it, feels it, and knows all there is to know about it, its cause, its effects, its possibilities, so far at least as the mental and lower planes are concerned, by the one instantaneous operation. There is never any doubt, hesitation, or delay about this direct action of the higher sense. If he thinks of a place, he is there; if of a friend, that friend is before him. No longer can misunderstandings arise, no longer can he be deceived or misled by any outward appearances, for every thought and feeling of his friend lies open as a book before him on that plane. If the man is with a friend whose higher sense is also open, their intercourse is perfect beyond all earthly conception. For them distance and separation do not exist, their feelings are no longer hidden, or at best but half expressed by clumsy words, question and answer are unnecessary, for the thought pictures are read as they are formed, and the interchange of ideas is as rapid as is their flashing into existence in the mind. Yet even this wonderful faculty differs in degree only and not in kind from those which are at our command at the present time. For on the mental plane, just as page 113 on the physical, impressions are still conveyed by means of vibrations traveling from the object seen to the seer. This condition does not apply on the Buddhic plane, but with that we are not concerned in this book. There is not very much that can or should be said regarding mental clairvoyance, because it is highly improbable that any example of it will be met with except among pupils properly trained. In some of the highest schools of occultism, for them it opens up a new world in which all that we can imagine of utmost glory and splendor is the commonplace of existence. All that it has to give, all of it at least that he can assimilate, is within the reach of the trained pupil, but for the untrained clairvoyant to touch it is hardly more than a bare possibility. Probably not one in a thousand among ordinary clairvoyants ever reach it at all. It has been reached in mesmeric trance when the subject has slipped from the control of the operator, but the occurrence is exceedingly rare, as it needs almost superhuman qualifications in the way of lofty spiritual aspiration and absolute purity of thought and intention upon the part both of the subject and the operator. Even in such cases the subject has rarely brought back more than a faint recollection of an intense but indescribable bliss, generally deeply colored by his personal religious convictions. Not only is all knowledge, all, that is, which does not transcend the mental plane, available to those functioning on the mental plane, but the past of the world is as open to them as the present, for they have access to the indelible memory of nature, see chapter 28. Thus, for example, for one who can function freely in the mental body, there are methods of getting at the meaning of a book quite apart from the process of reading it. The simplest is to read from the mind of one who has studied it, but this, of course, is open to the objection that one reaches only the student's conception of the book. A second plan is to examine the aura of the book. Each book is surrounded by a thought-aura built up by the thoughts of all who have read and studied it. Thus the psychometrization of a book generally yields a fairly full comprehension of its contents, though of course, there may be a considerable fringe of opinions held by the various readers but not expressed in the book itself. As mentioned in Chapter 8, in view of the fact that few readers at the present day seem to study so thoughtfully and thoroughly as did the men of old, the thought forms connected with a modern book are rarely so precise and clear-cut as those which surround the manuscripts of the past. A third plan is to go behind the book or manuscript altogether and touch the mind of the author, as described in Chapter 10. Yet a fourth method, requiring higher powers, is to psychometrize the subject of the book and visit mentally the thought center of its subject where all the streams of thought about the subject converge. This matter has been dealt with in Chapter 12 on thought centers. In order to be able to make observations on the mental plane, it is necessary for a man very carefully to suspend his thought for a time, so that its creations may not influence the readily impressible matter around him, and thus alter entirely the conditions so far as he is concerned. This holding the mind in suspense must not be confounded with the blankness of mind, towards the attainment of which so many Hatha Yoga practices are directed. In the latter case the mind is dulled down into absolute passivity, the condition closely approaching mediumship. In the former the mind is keenly alert and positive as it can be, holding its thought is suspense for the moment merely to prevent the intrusion of a personal equation into the observation which it wishes to make. Chakrams, or force centers, exist in the mental body just as they do in all the other vehicles. They are points of connection at which force flows from one vehicle to another. The chakrams in the etheric body have been described in the etheric body, p. 22, etc., and those in the astral body and the astral body, p. 31, etc. At present there is very little information available regarding the chakrams in the mental body. One item of information is the following: in one type of person the chakram at the top of the head is bent or slanted until its vortex coincides with the atrophied organ known as the pineal gland, which is by people of this type vivified and made into a line of communication directly with the lower mental, without apparently passing through the intermediate astral plane in the ordinary way. It was for this type that Madame Blavatsky was writing when she laid such emphasis upon the awakening of that organ. Another fact is that the faculty of magnification, called by the Hindus anima, belongs to the chakram between the eyebrows. From the center portion of that chakram is projected what we may call a tiny microscope, having for its lens only one atom, thus providing an organ commensurate in size with the minute objects to be observed. The atom employed may be either physical, astral or mental, but whichever it is it needs a special preparation. All its spirally must be opened up and brought into full working order so that it is just as it will be in the seventh round of our chain. The power belongs to the causal body, so if an atom of lower level be used as an eyepiece, a system of reflecting counterparts must be introduced. The atom can be adjusted to any subplane, so that any required degree of magnification can be applied in order to suit the object which is being examined. A further extension of the power enables the operator to focus his consciousness in the lens, and then to project it to distant points. The same power also, by a different arrangement, can be used for diminishing purposes when one wishes to view as a whole something far too large to be taken in at once by ordinary vision. This is known to the Hindus as Mahima. There is no spatial limit to mental clairvoyance beyond that of the mental plane itself, which, as we shall see in Chapter 27, does not extend to the mental planes of other planets. Nevertheless, it is possible by mental clairvoyance to obtain a good deal of information about other planets. By passing outside of the constant disturbances of the Earth's atmosphere, it is possible to make sight enormously clearer. It is also not difficult to learn how to put on an exceedingly high magnifying power, by means of which very interesting astronomical information may be gained. Prana or vitality exists on the mental plane, as it does on all planes of which we know anything. The same is true with regard to Kundalini or the serpent fire, and also with regard to Fohat or electricity, and to the life force referred to as the etheric double as the primary force. Of prana and kundalini on the mental plane scarcely anything appears at present to be known. We know, however, that kundalini vivifies all the various vehicles. The primary force, mentioned above, is one of the expressions of the second outpouring from the second aspect of the Logos. On the buddhic level it manifests itself as the Christ principle in man. In the mental and astral bodies it vivifies various layers of matter, appearing in the higher part of the astral as a noble emotion, and in the lower part as a mere rush of life force energizing the matter of that body. In its lowest embodiment it is clothed in etheric matter, and rushes from the astral body into the chakrams in the surface of the etheric body, where it meets the kundalini which wells up from the interior of the human body. The student will recollect, Vidhi the etheric double p.44, that the stream of violet prana stimulates thought and emotion of a high spiritual type, ordinary thought being stimulated by the action of the blue stream mingled with part of the yellow, also that in some kinds of idiocy the flow of vitality to the brain, both yellow and blue-violet, is almost entirely inhibited. Since the etheric double was published, C.W. Leadbeater's book The Chakras has appeared, containing some new and valuable information regarding the chakras, and particularly regarding the connection between the various centers or chakrams and the planes. The student therefore, may find the following tables useful: : Table of chakrams no. English name Sanskrit situation spokes group forces with which associated 1 root 4 basic muladhara base of spine 4, physiological kundalini 2 spleen or splenic, over spleen 6 prana. 3 navel or umbilical manipura navel, over solar plexus 10 2 personal lower astral 4 heart or cardiac anahata over heart 12 high astral 5 throat or laryngeal vishuddha front of throat 16 lower mental 6 brow or frontal ajna between eyebrows 96 3 spiritual higher forces through pituitary body 7 crown or coronal sahasrara top of head 12 960 higher forces through pineal gland. From the above it appears that the primary force, prana and kundalini, are not directly connected with man's mental and emotional life, but only with his bodily well-being. There are, however, also other forces entering the chakrams which may be described as psychic and spiritual. The basal and splenic chakrams exhibit none of these, but the navel and higher chakrams are ports of entry for forces which affect human consciousness. There seems to be a certain correspondence between the colors of the streams of prana which flow to the several chakrams and the colors assigned by H.P. Blavatsky to the principles of man in the diagram in The Secret Doctrine, Volume 3, p. 452, as shown in the following table. Colors of prana chakrams entered. Colors given in Secret Doctrine principles represented light blue throat blue atma, auric envelope, yellow heart yellow buddhi. Dark blue brow indigo or dark blue higher manas green navel green karma manas, lower mind rose spleen red karma rupa violet crown violet etheric double violet, red, with another violet, root, afterwards to crown, - kundalini belongs to the first outpouring, coming from the third aspect. In the center of the earth it operates in a vast globe, only the outer layers of which can be approached. These are in sympathetic relationship with the layers of kundalini in the human body. Thus the kundalini in the human body comes from what has been called the laboratory of the Holy Ghost deep down in the earth. It belongs to the fire of prana and vitality. Prana belongs to air and light and open spaces. The fire from below is much more material, like the fire in a red-hot iron. There is a rather terrible side to this tremendous force. It gives the impression of descending deeper and deeper into matter, of moving slowly but irresistibly onwards, with relentless certainty. It should be noted that kundalini is the power of the first outpouring on its path of return, and it works in intimate contact with the primary force already mentioned, and the two together bringing an evolving creature to the point where it can receive the outpouring of the first logos and become a human ego. The premature unfoldment of kundalini has many unpleasant possibilities. It intensifies everything in the man's nature, and it reaches the lower and evil qualities more readily than the good. In the mental body, for example, ambition is very readily aroused, and soon swells to an incredibly inordinate degree. It would be likely to bring with it a great intensification of the power of intellect, but at the same time it would produce abnormal and satanic pride, such as is quite inconceivable to the ordinary man. No uninstructed man should ever try to arouse it, and if such an one finds that it has been aroused by accident, he should at once consult someone who fully understands these matters. It has been said in the Thayogapradipika, 3.107, it gives liberation to yogis, and bondage to fools. The conquest of Kundalini has to be repeated in each incarnation, since the vehicles are new each time, but after it has been thoroughly achieved, its repetition will be an easy matter. It must be remembered that its action varies with different types of people. Some, for example, would see the higher self rather than hear its voice. Again, this connection with the higher has many stages. For the personality, it means the influence of the ego, but for the ego it means the power of the monad, and for the monad in turn it means to become a conscious expression of the logos. In order to use the faculties of the mental body, it is necessary, furthermore, to focus the consciousness in that body. The consciousness of man can be focused only in one vehicle at a time, though he may be conscious through the others in a vague way. Thus, if a man possessed of astral and mental sight focuses his consciousness in the physical brain, he will see perfectly the physical bodies of his friends, but will at the same time see their astral and mental bodies somewhat dimly. In far less than a moment he can change that focus so that he will see the astral quite fully and perfectly. In that case he will still see the mental and physical bodies, but not in full detail. The same thing is true of the mental sight and of the sight of the higher planes. In bringing down to the physical brain what has been seen on the mental plane, there has to be performed the difficult operation of a double transference from the higher to the lower, since the memory has to be brought through the intervening astral plane. Even when the mental faculties can be used whilst awake in the physical body, the investigator is still hampered by the absolute incapacity of physical language to express what he sees. In order to bring the consciousness of the mental body into the physical brain, the links between the different bodies must be developed. These links exist at first without coming into the consciousness of the man, and they are not actively vivified, being like what are called in the physical body rudimentary organs that are waiting to be developed by use. Such links connect the dense and etheric bodies with the astral with the mental body, the mental with the causal body. The action of their will begins to vivify them, and as they commence to function, the man uses them for the passing of his consciousness from vehicle to vehicle. The use of the will vivifying the links sets free Kundalini, the serpent fire. The link between the physical and the astral body is the pituitary body, that between the physical and the mental body is the pineal gland. As was mentioned before, some people develop the pituitary body first, some the pineal gland. Each must follow the method prescribed by his own guru, or spiritual teacher. When a man has learnt to leave the physical body in waking consciousness, having developed the links between his vehicles, he has, of course, bridged the gulf between physical life and sleep life. The bridging of the gulf is facilitated by training the brain to respond to vibrations from the mental body. The brain then becomes more and more the obedient instrument of the man, carrying on its activities under impulses from the will and answering to the lightest touch. The main preparations to be made for receiving in the physical vehicle the vibrations of the higher consciousness may usefully be summarized as follows: purification of the lower bodies by pure food and pure life, entire subjugation of the passions, the cultivation of an even, balanced temper and mind, unaffected by the turmoil and vicissitudes of external life, the habit of quiet meditation, see chapters 15 to 17, on lofty topics, the cessation of hurry, especially of that restless, excitable hurry of the mind, which keeps the brain continually at work flying from one thing to another, the genuine love for things of the higher world, so that the mind rests contentedly in their companionship, as in that of a well-loved friend. When a man is able to use the mental faculties in ordinary waking consciousness, he is, of course, able to receive impressions of every kind from the mental world, so that all the workings of others are sensed by him just as he sees their bodily movements. In learning to use the powers of the mental body, a man does not lose those of the lower, for they are included in the higher. At this stage, a man can also increase his powers of usefulness very largely by consciously creating and directing a thought form, which he can use to do work in places to which, at the moment, it may not be convenient to travel in his mental body. These are thought forms he controls from a distance, watching and guiding them as they work, and making them the agents of his will. When a man begins to develop along occult lines, the whole of the mental body, as said, must be purified and brought into thorough working order. It is eminently necessary that he should be able to make strong and clear thought forms. In addition, it is a great help and comfort to him if he is able to visualize them clearly. The two acts must not be confused. The formation of a thought is a direct action of the will, working through the mental body. Visualization is simply the power to see clairvoyantly the thought form he has made. If a man thinks strongly of any object, the image of it is in his mental body just as much, whether he can visualize it or not. The student must also continuously strive to maintain of moral purity and mental balance, without which clairvoyance is a curse and not a blessing to its possessor. Development of mental body consciousness would make a man's life and memory continuous during the whole of each descent into incarnation. When a man can thus function consciously in his mental body, experiencing its powers and its limitations, of necessity he also learns to distinguish between the vehicle he is using and himself. The next stage will be for him to perceive the illusory character of the personal I, the I of the mental body, and to identify himself with the real man, the individuality or ego, living in the causal body. This further step of raising the consciousness to the level of the ego on the higher mental plane would confer on the man memory of all his past lives. But before a man can hope to break the barrier between the mental and astral plane, so that he can have the pleasure of continuous recollection, he must have been for a long time thoroughly practiced in the use of the mental body as a vehicle. Analogy leads us to see that the ego must have been fully conscious and active on his own plane for a long time before any knowledge of that existence can come through to the physical consciousness. The mental body, as such, is incapable of fatigue. There is no such thing as fatigue of the mind. What we call by that name is only fatigue of the physical brain through which the mind has to express itself. Nevertheless, purely physical fatigue can produce an effect upon the mental body. Thus, a man who is utterly exhausted has to a large extent lost the power of coordination. Every physical cell is complaining, and the effect upon all vehicles etheric, astral, and mental is that a vast number of small, separate vortices are set up, each quivering at its own rate, so that all the bodies lose their cohesion and their power to do their work. At the present state of our knowledge, the exact method by which ordinary memory works is not known, the subject not having been investigated. It is clear, however, that a vibration in the mental body is part of what occurs, and that the causal body is not in any way involved. Many thousands of years ago, there appears to have been a certain ceremony, aimed at opening the faculties of the higher bodies. The officiant, in a dark room, uttered the word Om, which brought all those present into close harmony with him, and with the feelings which filled his mind. At the utterance of the word Ba, the room was filled, to their senses, with ordinary light. On the sound of another word, astral sight was temporarily opened to them. Another word similarly opened their mental sight. Such effects were temporary only, but on a future occasion it would, of course, be easier to produce the same result on those people. It is important that the student should learn to distinguish between impulse and intuition. As both come to the brain from within, they seem at first exactly alike, and therefore, great care is necessary. It is wise, where circumstances permit, to wait a while, because impulses usually grow weaker, while intuitions remain unaffected by the passage of time. An impulse is usually accompanied by excitement, and there is something personal about it. A true intuition, though decided, is surrounded by a sense of calm strength. The impulse is a surging of the astral body, An intuition is a scrap of knowledge from the ego impressed upon the personality, coming thus from the higher mental plane, or sometimes even from the buddhic. To distinguish between the impulse and intuition, until the nature is thoroughly balanced, calm consideration is necessary and delay, as said above, is essential. An impulse dies away under such conditions, whilst an intuition grows clearer and stronger. Calmness and serenity enable the lower mind more clearly to hear the intuition and to feel its power. Intuition thus loses nothing, but rather gains from calm delay.